The ACEC Research Institute recently released the groundbreaking 2020 Engineering Industry Profile. Now, this study provides the most comprehensive view we have ever seen for the entire engineering, architectural, and related services sectors. We're talking 3% of all U.S. jobs, $386 billion in revenue, nearly $45 billion in tax dollars, an $88,000 a year average salary, and so much more. The study also benchmarks state-level activities. Now take the opportunity to download your free copy today. Get the 2020 Engineering Industry Profile by visiting acecresearchinstitute.org. Download your copy today.
Welcome to the Engineering Influence Podcast, brought to you by the American Council of Engineering Companies. The rapid expansion of renewable energy generation will be the pivotal factor in slowing climate change. Over the past few decades, solar and wind energy technologies in production have made tremendous advances, but we may be on the cusp of truly dynamic change. Deloitte recently released its 2021 Renewable Energy Outlook, which highlights several trends that point towards a huge growth in the renewable energy sector. The author of that report, Marlene Motyka, who is the U.S. and global renewable energy leader at Deloitte, has joined us on the program to discuss the current state and future prospects for renewable energy. So let's get into it. There have been reports in recent months that solar and/or wind generation have achieved cost parity with carbon-based generation. Is this true? And if so, what is the impact?
Yeah, Jerry, the answer to your first question is yes. Over the past decade, as the levelized cost of energy, or LCOE, has decreased over 70% for wind and 90% for utility scale solar, you know, these renewables have achieved cost parity with carbon-based generation across most of the world. And they've done so while also increasing technology efficiency and capacity factors. And these price declines and technology improvements are continuing. And really the impact is hard to overstate. You know, today it means that new wind and solar are more cost-effective to build than new fossil fuel plants. And the LCOE ranges for solar photovoltaic or PV and onshore wind are below that of natural gas and below the cost of running many coal plants. And new build renewables are also increasingly becoming competitive with the cost of running existing natural gas and nuclear plants and are on track to undercut them in the next few years. So as a result, you know, we think the energy transition is on the cusp of really rapid acceleration, even in states without renewable portfolio standards, because of the low costs resulting from market fundamentals and tax incentives. So we hear a lot about decarbonization, and really what we're saying is it's affordable. And despite the pandemic and federal policy headwinds in 2020, renewable deployment was surging. US PV capacity deployments hit record highs in 2020 and expected to do the same in 2021. And onshore wind in 2020 also recorded the largest capacity addition since 2012, while offshore wind is really poised to take off in the coming years.
So to your point that federal policy can have a big impact on the renewable energy market, in the year-end spending bill, the Congress extended the tax credits for the solar, wind, and other energy renewable energy technologies. How will that affect the market?
Yeah, we got a year-end little treat here. We tend to sometimes have that with regard to these tax incentives for the renewable space, but really surpassing most industry expectations, the two-year extension of the 26% investment tax credit, or ITC, could provide a significant boost to the outlook for solar deployments, as could the maintained 60% production tax credit for wind through the end of 2021 for onshore wind deployments. And the extensions may also provide the biggest boost to offshore wind starts, which are now eligible for a 30% ITC for projects that start construction before the end of 2025. So besides boosting solar and onshore and offshore wind deployments, you know, these extensions could also ease concerns about missing deadlines due to pandemic-related supply chain disruptions that happened in 2020, and also provide additional certainty for investments in domestic manufacturing and recycling, as well as port facilities for the nascent offshore wind industry in the U.S. You know, on top of that, the stimulus package had additional billions of dollars for funding for renewable R&D and grid modernization, and that could really help accelerate technology innovation and the deployment of hybrid platforms that include emerging renewables such as marine power, as well as emerging storage technologies.
The Biden administration has expressed its intention to support renewable energy. Is that going to have an impact, do you think, over the next few years?
Yeah, there's been a lot of buzz about this topic, Jerry. And with the Democratic Senate and House control, the Biden administration will have a window of opportunity to really usher in some ambitious clean energy legislation. I mean, they don't have a filibuster-proof majority, so the administration may need to integrate its decarbonization and clean energy targets into broader infrastructure stimulus package. But the Congressional Review Act and simple majorities will allow for reversals of many of the previous administration's regulatory rollbacks, executive decisions to streamline permitting and provide regulatory support for renewables, a creation of a clean energy standard, establishment of a new green bank, and as most people may be aware, the U.S. rejoining the Paris Accord. In any case, you know, I think the Biden's administration's commitment to decarbonization is going to really turbocharge the cost, customer, and sub-federal forces that have really been driving clean energy investment and deployment over the past 4 years. I think another thing to point out is the Biden administration's appointment of a Democratic chair for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, would also have a significant impact on the power sector's decarbonization by 2035. As a shift in FERC could brighten the prospects for ruling supported of clean energy resources' ability to clear energy markets and states seeking greater deployment of renewables. It could also facilitate the build out of transmission that really will be needed to integrate higher shares of renewables on the grid. And finally, FERC will be key to reshaping electricity markets to ensure, you know, resource adequacy, grid reliability, and limited price volatility amid the planned rapid increase of renewable penetration and the corresponding fossil fuel plant retirements.
In your report, you highlight the increasing size of offshore wind turbines, I guess up to about 14 megawatts. And can we expect to see ongoing technological advances in both solar and wind to make them even more cost competitive?
Yes, I think we can. I mean, I think while solar and wind are already both mature technologies, we can expect to see ongoing technology advances that will make them even more cost competitive. You know, when we look at solar, bifacial solar recently achieved cost competitiveness with single side solar modules and could soon overtake them. And there's also optimization of tilt angles and ground reflectance that are expected to further drive costs down. Second, new materials that can absorb a broader range of solar spectrum could push efficiency past the upper bounds for silicon cells. And these include silicon cells layered with perovskite, which are nearing commercialization, and other cells using multiple non-silicon materials. In addition, there are innovative inverter technologies that are enabling more flexible grid-enhanced deployments of solar power. Third, I'd like to point out California's new home solar requirements, which are driving innovation and partnership between solar developers, builders, roofers, to commercialize building integrated PV that really hits the sweet spot between efficiency, affordability, and aesthetics. And then on the wind side, you know, the wind industry really hasn't hit a point of diminished returns yet on increased scale. And you mentioned 14, you know, megawatt turbines. So really wind, bigger is better. And with larger turbines, you're able to really drive down manufacturing and maintenance costs, but at the same time, increasing revenue. And there's been a lot of material innovation, which is continuing to enable these larger turbines. And then also we do have floating wind technologies that are maturing and becoming increasingly competitive.
And touching on floating wind technologies, what is that arena?
Yeah, so that's really exciting. So just to briefly to mention, floating offshore wind uses semi-submersed structures that are tethered to the seabed rather than fixed to it with foundations. And the advantage of floating offshore wind plants is that they can be deployed at depths beyond the 165-foot limit for fixed foundation offshore wind. So most offshore wind resources are actually located beyond this point, including much on the West Coast. So the ability to deploy floating offshore wind opens much more generation capacity for the U.S. And also deployment in deeper waters and further from shoreline could also yield higher capacity factors. You know, another advantage of floating wind platforms is that they could host other technologies. Currently, developers are exploring enhanced structures that could lower costs via hybridization of floating platforms with complementary tidal, wave, and ocean thermal energy generation, as well as floating solar generation. So a lot of exciting things happening there.
Another area that sounds pretty exciting is hydrogen and power to X. You did a pretty deep dive into that. What are those bode for the future?
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion about hybrid hydrogen. It's really kind of just popped up, I would say, really in the last year in full force. And hydrogen and power to X technologies, I think, are going to play a significant role in closing the last 20% of the decarbonization gap, which we expect around the 2040 timeline. And that's when heating and industrial sectors are really expected to transition away from natural gas and the transportation sector transition away from oil. So they're expected to increasingly refuel with electricity. And for example, you'll see heat pumps replacing gas furnaces in buildings and advanced electrothermal technologies replace gas and industrial processes. And in areas where electrification is least feasible, green hydrogen is one of the only solutions right now that can help decarbonization of all the remaining hard to abate sectors from heavy industry to long haul transportation. Green hydrogen is also one of the few solutions to renewable integration challenges at high levels of penetration. So when we think about renewable penetration, that's needed to cross that 20% threshold, that last 20% threshold, there's going to be integration challenges that are much greater for renewables. So significant overbuild and curtailment of renewables may occur without large-scale seasonal storage to capture excess renewable production, which can be used when renewable production drops off for long periods of time. And hydrogen could seasonally store renewables in liquid, gas, and chemical form and convert that back to power when needed. There is really no commercially operational hydrogen power plants in the world yet, but utilities are looking to cost-effectively start retrofitting some gas plants to partially or fully run on hydrogen. Also, islanded green hydrogen can support an energy system as greater economy-wide electrification strains grid capacity. So we talked about offshore wind, and as deployment increasingly moves offshore and into deeper water, hydrogen pipelines could supplement high voltage transmission to bring the energy onshore and might really be the most cost-effective energy carrier in areas where there is high grid congestion along some of the East Coast areas. And just last week in the European Commission granted a consortium, which is being led by Ørsted, 5 million euros to help develop desalinization and electrolysis system for an offshore wind deployment to produce green hydrogen. So that's really exciting. And I think there's a lot of interesting things to come with hydrogen and really renewable supporting green hydrogen.
One of the challenges in over the past few years has been the solar specifically, it only works when the sun's shining and such. And a lot of focus was on storage. Yeah. And it was considered to be the missing link in the expansion of renewable energy. Where are we with storage technology right now?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of evolutions, but there is more to come here. And the surge of renewables on the grid required to reach the decarbonization goals that we're being set, will require energy storage, and that will allow for system flexibility. But really, the capacity is going to be needed to grow. The capacity of storage is going to need to grow exponentially from where it currently is to support the record levels of renewable deployment we expect. And when we look at current energy storage deployment, there are dominated kind of by two technologies. The first is electrochemical lithium ion battery technology and mechanical pumped hydro storage, or PHS. And these two technologies in some ways are kind of at the opposite ends of the spectrum when you look at energy storage options. So on the one hand, you have dynamic lithium ion battery technology, which can competitively provide 4-hour storage almost anywhere, and is experiencing rapidly falling cost, increasing density, and other material and chemical advances. So that's great. But meanwhile, pumped hydro storage is a longstanding but geographically constrained technology with higher stable cost that's recently seen an uptick in deployment as it can provide longer duration storage. And subsea PHS is a new frontier that some offshore wind developers are starting to explore. But in between these two types of energy storage technologies are a host of evolving mechanical and battery storage technologies offering hourly, intraday, interday, and even weekly storage. And this will help support the grid in many different ways. But I think a key is that we have to see the opening of additional revenue streams to support the use cases of energy storage. So energy storage can be responsible for primary response. It can be used for energy arbitrage, peaker replacement, secondary response, and even support distribution and transmission deferral. But to really help accelerate the deployment of these storage technologies, again, we need the markets to compensate these technologies for the value that they're adding to the grid.
And just on that, how does that happen, or how do you expect that to happen? How do you expect the market to compensate?
Well, the FERC is going to be key to that. You know, they've set out some guidelines that talked about the RTOs needing to create structures and pricing signals that will allow battery storage and other types of distributed energy resources to be compensated for the services they add. And it will take time for this to unroll, but we expect this to continue to evolve. And as I mentioned earlier, with the fact that the Biden administration can put a Democrat in place to lead FERC, we think that will continue to just support the rollout of these technologies.
Looking farther into the future, I mean, in 2019, renewables accounted for about 17.6% of U.S. power generation. Where do you see that number going over the coming years?
Jerry, I think there's an interesting time to come here. When we look at this combination of plummeting cost, technology innovation, government and utility targets, corporate and citizen demand for renewables, the ITC and PTC extensions I mentioned earlier, and the new administration, We're really going to see, I think, unprecedented renewable investment and growth, because everybody's going to be moving towards this common goal to fully decarbonize the economy by 2050. And the targets that are going to be required to meet those goals are going to result in record annual deployments of wind and solar, because that's really going to be the bulk of US generation that's going to be built by mid-century. And Deloitte recently issued a report on utility decarbonization. And we said in that study, without other decarbonization solutions, these renewables would need to be able to meet 3 to 8 times peak demand to ensure adequate generation when the sun and wind resources availability is at its lowest, even with storage in the mix there. And total capacity additions may need to surpass total existing generation capacity to make up for the coal share that needs to be replaced, as well as planned and retiring natural gas. And I do want to point out that now over 280 companies across the globe have pledged to have 100% of their electricity from renewable energy sources no later than 2050. So all of this is coming together. And I think, to sum it up, Jerry, is that I see very large growth in renewables in the coming years and in the longer term as well.
And finally, funding is moving into renewable energy with funding coming from large oil and gas producers. Does this mark a turning point, do you think, for the renewable energy market sector?
Yeah, I think you pointed out oil and gas companies, and we see them being poised to leverage their deep expertise in offshore environments and bring that to the U.S. offshore wind industry, which is really just starting to evolve and grow. And this could provide them relatively stable revenues, but also lower their carbon footprints. And we think also oil companies could be well positioned to hybridize offshore wind projects with green hydrogen production. And this could be a new industry area for the oil industry to leverage their existing expertise. But with the broad goals from the Biden administration related to clean technology and decarbonization of the economy, I think there's an expectation that investment in renewable sector will increase and attract new players across the globe with a variety of different backgrounds and coming from different industry sectors. So I think no doubt there are going to be some really interesting times ahead, and this is going to be a very interesting industry sector.
You sound pretty optimistic about it, I would say.
I do. I'm very excited.
Well, that's great. That's a great place to stop. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Appreciate the time.
The ACEC Research Institute recently released the groundbreaking 2020 Engineering Industry Profile. Now, this study provides the most comprehensive view we have ever seen for the entire engineering, architectural, and related services sectors. We're talking 3% of all U.S. jobs, $386 billion in revenue, nearly $45 billion in tax dollars, an $88,000 a year average salary, and so much more. The study also benchmarks state-level activities. Now take the opportunity to download your free copy today. Get the 2020 Engineering Industry Profile by visiting acecresearchinstitute.org. Download your copy today.